like they're both on here. Okay, excellent. Okay, we have an hour and 5 minutes to do the entire holiday of Passover.
It's a snap.
Yeah. So of course, not enough time, but it's just an introduction, but we'll hopefully talk about some things maybe you haven't heard about before. So I want to start out with the names, the name of the holiday. In Hebrew, it's Pesach. In English, it's Passover. It means the same thing. Both words are the same thing. So why is it called this? I'm going to let you think about it just for a second. Why is this holiday called Passover?
Passed over the firstborn.
Okay, so is it possible that the holiday, the entire holiday, let's just think for a second. Let's make you a committee. Okay, you name the holiday. What's the essence? Well, shouldn't you name the holiday after the essence of the day? Exodus. What would be the right thing to name it?
Freedom.
Exodus.
Freedom Day, Exodus Day.
Survival.
But that is the birth, sign of survival.
Birth of a Jewish nation. Right? It's interesting. That's the 10th plague. So you're going to name the whole holiday Survival Day, Birth Day, Exodus Day, Freedom Day, Birth of the Jewish People Day. We should be naming after one of the 10 plagues? Doesn't really make sense.
But it's like the tipping point. It's the point where it became, it passed from being slavery and everything to...
Not exactly. It's just the 10th plague. We weren't out yet.
But isn't it the one that
we saved the generation?
Like, we wouldn't have left until the 10th plague happened.
Okay, so let's talk about that too. That's just skipping down to the third thing. Pretend you're God, as long as we're in committee mode, okay? You're God, okay? Just think for a minute. You're God. Your favorite people is enslaved by an evil nation. You have everything at your disposal because you're God. How will you get them out? How? How will you get them out? Do you need 10 plagues? Do you need permission of the leader? You're God, for crying out loud.
He tried to give to make their own decisions, yeah. And he gave them chances.
Okay, what's with the hardening of the heart then?
That was after.
That was after the sixth plague or something.
That was in between, right? So
there have been a number of chances before.
Uh huh. But so then, let's say he did want Pharaoh to exercise free will. I mean, think about this. I just think, because you're so used to hearing the story and accepting it the way you've heard it, whatever way it is, whether it's, you know, a full-blown story or a child story, whatever it is, but you're God. Your favorite people is enslaved by an evil nation. You want to get them out because you have a mission for them. They're on a mission from God, right? You want to give them the mission now. Now it's time to charge them with the mission. That's Sinai. Charging them with the mission, right? You want to charge them with the mission, so in order to do that, you have to take them out of slavery and bring them to the charging station, right? So how are you going to get them out? Does it really matter if Pharaoh agrees? Do you really need to get his consent? Do you really need to get the consent of the Egyptian people? Is it really a time to be working with his free will?
Maybe he needed the Jewish people to really understand how powerful he was.
That God needed the Jewish people to understand how powerful he was? Good, good. Okay.
But there's also a lesson to be learned. I mean, by allowing the Egyptians an opportunity to let his people go. I mean, he's teaching us via that we have to give. You know, sometimes we have to give in order to get. We can't.
So clearly there's more going on here than getting the people out. Because if you're God and you just want to get the people out, so you take them out, right? All you have to do is scoop them out and bring them to Sinai. You don't need plagues. You don't need agreeing. You don't need conversations. You don't need anything, really. Just move them where you need them. You can do that. You could make a force field. You could freeze the Egyptians. You could just whisk them out. I mean, there's lots of... He did lots of magical, mystical things. So why stop there? Why with the locusts and the hail with the fire in it and the death of the firstborn and discerning who was the firstborn? You know, even all affairs were found. You know, I'm sure Rabbi Liebman told you about that. Firstborn of affairs, too. You didn't even know necessarily who was firstborn until you find out who's sleeping sleeping with who and where and what? Who's really the firstborn? You might think your kid's the firstborn, but it's not the firstborn because there's an affair first and it's really the secondborn. Like, so all the firstborns and revealing all that immorality too. Like, so lots of things were going on. So if he's prepared to do mystical, magical things for display, so why not just put them all on a magic carpet and fly them? I mean, like, really, there's a lot of different options here if you're God, right?
But we weren't really ready to leave in the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
Right. You want me to finish that thought?
Go. I'm just saying. I just want you to be thinking.
I'm not sure I'm just going to go there. But part of this was that after each plague, we also, something happened to us after each plague. Sometimes it was retribution for the plague, so that we needed to be ready to leave.
Good. So clearly there's stuff going on here. Because we've established that if you're God and your favorite people is enslaved by an evil nation and you want to take them out, you can just take them out. So clearly if he chose not to just take them out, but rather to display his majesty in 10 different ways so that the Jews and the Egyptians and the whole world actually heard about it, so that it was international news, clearly there's another program going on. Right? It's not just about getting us out. So still then, the question remains, why name the whole thing Passover? Right? Because that seems strange. It could be plagues. It could be display of power. It could be, there's lots of different names you could pick. Why that one? It's not necessarily the tipping point. It was the last of the plagues, but we were then taken out, and then we whined and moaned, and then there was the sea splitting, and then they were chasing us, and then we made it through, and then, you know, it could be called holiday, right? So,
that's how you feel after you get ready for it.
Right? This is my mother, by the way. So there's a lot of different possibilities of what it could be called. But it's chosen to be called Passover, right? So we'll talk about that in a minute. But clearly, there's another agenda happening. So what happened? So the story, you know, right? The Jews go, well, let's back up a little bit. Abraham and God become pals, right? Because Abraham recognizes God. Not because God taps Abraham, but because Abraham taps God. And then God talks back. Oh, finally, somebody recognizes me? Whew. I've been waiting for 2,000 years for somebody to recognize me. Remember, he was born in 1948, according to our calendar today, which is easy to remember because 1948 is the establishment of the State of Israel, according to the 2011 calendar today. So according to 5771 calendar, he was born in 1948. So there's two 1948s. Yeah, pretty cool, right? So basically 2,000 years of human beings not really paying much attention to God at all, right? And then you have Abraham coming on the scene. He says, God, I get it. You are before, after, during everything you made, will make, have made everything. You're the one in charge. And if you existed before I existed and before everything existed, it means you didn't need us in order to exist, which means you didn't need us to continue existing, which means you didn't create us for you, but you created us for us. And that must mean that you want us to get something out of this whole program. And so that must mean, and he came up with ethical monotheism as a concept, not just for himself, but that it must mean all human beings should be tapped into a system of ethical monotheism. And so he was the first, not the first monotheist, the first monotheist with a mission. Right? So now he's a monotheist with a mission, and God says, phew, finally, somebody gets it. I'm going to work with him. So he has a conversation. It's called the covenant between the parts, where he says, Abraham, I get it. You get it. So thrilled. Your people are going to inherit the land of Israel. I'm going to give them a whole program on how to transform the whole world. And Abraham says, I'm paraphrasing, obviously, right? Okay, I get why I should be part of this program. How will my kids become part of this program? Right? And this is where he says, where will I know? And so then the covenant between the parts. So the answer, he's just saying, how will my kids earn this? And God's answer is, they're going to be slaves in Egypt, and they'll be terribly oppressed, and it's going to be miserable for them, and then they're going to be let out with a lot of stuff. What kind of answer is that? Like, so what God's really saying here is, I'm going to design a custom workshop for how they could also come to the same conclusions that you have come to. And how they will be separated from all humanity, because they are all humanity at this point. And then they become the Jews, which are a different segment of all humanity, but need a separation strategy. So first what happens, just on the Peshat level, because I wrote here what happened and what really happened. So what happens is they go into Egypt. You know, there's the whole Joseph story. And then they go in, and then they're there, and then they're enslaved slowly, and then they're let out through the plagues and the Exodus. Okay, now we get to Sinai. Okay, so that's what happened. That's a story. You all know that story. But what really happened is there had to be a program for how do you get this family, which didn't exist yet, right? It's just talking to Abraham. How are you going to get this? And Abraham at this point is still barren. How are you going to get this family to become the people that will be the seeds of the transformation of the world? Egypt, right? So that's why we're constantly talking about, remember for the exodus from Egypt, remember from the exodus from Egypt, remember the exodus. That happens to be a positive commandment in the Torah. Remember the exodus of Egypt, right? And so we might think back, how narcissistic are we? Constantly thinking about our birthday? You know, do we today as adults count down to our birthdays? Like my birthday is February 8th. But I can't tell you how many days it is until February 8th from now. You know, like I'm not counting down like a six-year-old is waiting to turn seven. They know, right? They know, right? But hopefully their mother isn't waking them up every morning and saying, remember your birthday in 182 days, right? We don't do that for our children. Even our children who are excited, we're not constantly hearkening back to their birth experience. You're so special because you were born. You're so special because you were born. You're so special. We're going to celebrate it. Every day we're celebrating it, right? But we do every day. Remember Egypt. Remember Egypt. Remember Egypt. It's not just about our birth. It's about our transformation into this special people who are the seeds of transformation of the entire planet. So what's going on is the Jews go down and then, right, we weren't ready. We weren't ready to receive the Torah. We weren't ready for the mission, right? Only Abraham basically was ready. Now he had his son, right? One who chose to take on the mission, one who chose not to, right? So Isaac now has his son, right? So Jacob, and another one who chooses in, one who chooses out. Now Jacob has his sons. Now there's a big question mark. There is a prophetic knowledge in this family so far. There's going to be a family of 12 sons, and that's going to be the beginning of this nation that's going to get this mission. So now Jacob has the 12. Whew, he's got 12. And now one is sold. And now he's thinking, oh, great. I thought I was the guy who was going to have the 12 sons. How is it possible that, I mean, where's the other family that's going to have the 12 sons? I have the 12. Now I'm down to 11. How am I supposed to do this whole prophetic thing with the 12 sons and I only have 11? That was part of the crisis of Joseph being sold. But then there's the whole reuniting, right? And at the very end of Jacob's life, he asks them, are you guys all on board? And there's the answering to him, where the sons actually answer, Shema Yisrael, Hashem Elokeinu, Hashem Echad. Hear Israel, because he's Jacob Israel, right? Hear Israel, your vision of Hashem is our vision of Hashem. We have the same vision. We all share that vision. Yes, we're in this program. You can die peacefully. The 12 of us are on board. Okay, so now the story continues. But still, the children are not fully educated, not fully on board, much like all of us today still. We're not fully there, all of us, right? But there's still something about being Jewish, but in order for us to be separated out and to really get this program, to get charged with the mission, there had to be something big. So there had to be a big display. So the big display, I gave you an article here, which only touches on it, but you know, we're only touching on things. But tens are a big thing in Judaism, numbers altogether. You can read the article at your leisure. It's just a touch on, and I gave the website, the sources at the end, Rabbi Yitzchak Ginsburg, who's a Kabbalist type. He's written several books, but whatever, he's an interesting guy, and you can look up some of his information. But so this is talking about the ten statements of the creation of the world. Right? The first one is in the beginning, and then there's let there be, God said, let there be, you know, light, grass, animals, let us make man, all those. There's 10 of those statements. So 10 statements of the creation of the world, 10 plagues, 10 commandments. They all line up. I wanted to be able to figure out how to line it all up for you. I can't do it yet. but I can tell you how the plagues and the statements of creation line up, only the first two. They line up inverted so that they go backwards. So the 10 statements of creation, the first one is in the beginning. The second one is let there be light, etc. The plagues backwards, the last one is killing of the firstborn. That's beginnings, right? The second to the last one is darkness, which is opposite light, right? And they go like that. Those two are very easy to see. If all 10 were that easy, I could breeze through them for you. It's much more complicated, the last eight. But there's thematic ways that they relate. So what's going on here? No human being was there to witness the creation of the world. And as you know, and let me reiterate just with my son who challenges me constantly on this, the Torah is not a book of science. And the statements of Genesis are not scientific. So you do not have to get hung up in how were there plants before there was a sun or anything like that. We do not see the Torah as a book of science at all. There are things to learn from it. So what one of the things that we can learn from those 10 statements is God is in charge of all realms, and that's 10 different realms of creation. And the 10 plagues are also 10 different realms of power, the same, they match up exactly the same, but now there's human beings to see. God is in charge of how things work. He's in charge of birth, he's in charge of death, he's in charge of the sky, he's in charge of the earth, he's in charge of the winds, he's in charge of the sun, he's in charge of it all, which was very important for the Egyptians, slash all humanity, and for the Jews to see, especially in a pagan polytheistic society where you really, at that time, believed that there's different powers. Everybody understood there's powers, but that they thought there were different powers in charge of each thing to show that there's one God who can run it all, who's in charge of it all, and to make a display of that. I can run it all, the whole shebang. I'm in charge of the whole thing, for the Egyptians to see and for the Jews to see. That's not the way God wants to run the world. He does want there to be free will, but there needed to be an initial investment of, just look, I gotta show you first. Sort of like the doctor showing you, look, not that they do, but we check, I check anyway, on the wall, where did they graduate from? Right? You wanna see that diploma before you like trust. And I don't fully trust. I'm gonna check with Wikipedia or whatever too, some pathetic source, to make sure I should be taking that drug that they gave me, and it's not just because they got a pen, right, that said, prescribe whatever. I saw a funny YouTube drug ad and said, feeling fatigued, not thinking clearly, having trouble sleeping? Have you tried breathing? Breathing, breathing, breathing. And then they have testimonials. I wouldn't be alive today if not for breathing.
So two questions. One, so you told us that Abraham recognizes Hashem in 1948.
When, he's born in 1948. He recognizes a little bit later. Yeah.
Okay. So when does Moses lead the people out of Egypt?
It's about 400 years later, I think, approximately.
Okay. So 2000. Yeah.
It's approximately 3,500 years ago from now. So yeah, about.
And then, so you're going to get back to why, we still haven't answered, but why we have any Passover.
Right.
Okay.
Good. That's good. Okay, so now, we're excellent. Okay, so we're in Egypt, right? And we Jews have to be, this is our workshop. That was the answer. God said, your people, your children, your family is going to be prepared the same way you made this decision to stand on the other side of the whole world. That's why you're called Avraham HaIvri, Avraham the Hebrew, the one who stands on the other side, not just because you come geographically from the other side of the Jordan River, but because you stand philosophically on the other side of the entire world. How will your children become that way? Able to stand on the other side through this custom designed workshop of Egypt. So the first thing of Egypt is to squeeze us tight. And that's what happened. Squeezed extremely tight. Egypt, Mitzrayim, the root of the word is tsar, narrow. Tsuris is the same word as tsuris, which is difficulties, hardship. Right? So first we were squeezed extremely tight. Whole another discussion on suffering and why, and we're going to have to leave that aside for this talk. But squeezed extremely tight. Then once we're squeezed out so tight, whatever that means, negativity, regularness squeezed out of us as human beings, then like a squeezed out sponge when you go to like clean up a mess, right? So a squeezed out sponge actually does a very nice job of cleaning out, of absorbing, right? As opposed to a sponge that has something in it, or even a very dry one, doesn't do the same job as a wet one that's wrung out tight, right? That absorbs a lot more. So that's just a muscle, so even if you, that's just a parable, so even if you find physically that the absorption techniques doesn't work, you understand what I'm talking about. Okay, so we're squeezed out tight, we're brought to Sinai where we absorb. So first the dross had to be removed from us, and Egypt is considered the smelting pot. the place from which the dross was removed from us, so that we then had empty spaces ready to receive the Kedusha and the light, the holiness and the light of the Torah. So I think we discussed before that one of the roots of the word of Torah is or, light. And if we're supposed to be a light unto the nations, we have to first absorb that light. That's our light source. So we went to Sinai, we absorbed the light. learning the Chumash, still we weren't fully ready, right? And we're still traipsing through history, not completely compliant, certainly, or even mostly compliant. but still, we are a special nation that's chosen for a special mission, and we are destined towards that. But meanwhile, we had to be prepared initially for it. So this was the initial workshop. So that's what really was going on. So what the story that was going on is we went in, we were slaves, we got out, we went to Sinai. What really was going on is we went in, and it's a custom workshop to prepare us, to change us from regular human beings into Jews, to remove the dross, to absorb the Torah, and to absorb the display of those 10 plagues and what that means. Have that interaction, sort of like early childhood interactions with a parent. That's why you're not supposed to let a child cry, let's say, I think until 9 months, maybe it's even a little bit older. If you can pick them up right away, you're supposed to. You're not supposed to do cry therapy, right, in the earlier ages, because they have to first learn trust, right? They cry, you come. I know, you're there for me. So that was the early childhood, the infancy of the Jewish people, is God needed to put us in a place where we first developed that trust. That was part of the desert experience too, getting the manna every day and trusting that it would come again. That's why we could only gather enough for one day and it would spoil if you took too much, because it was an exercise in trust. I'll get it. It's going to come tomorrow. I do not have to save. I don't have to put aside for tomorrow because I'm going to get it tomorrow. And if I do put aside because I don't trust, it'll turn to wormy blech, right? And I have to pick it up the next day. Trust. It was an exercise in trust. So that whole Egypt and desert experience all together was our infancy as a nation, to an exercise in learning to be in relationship with God and to trust God in that relationship. That's supposed to carry us forward. It's not doing the easiest job right now. We have a hard time with it. So the first mitzvah of the experience is to remember it on a daily basis. So just have in mind, we're fulfilling a mitzvah right now. As we discuss it, we are remembering the exodus from Egypt. That's a mitzvah to do on a daily basis. So we're all fulfilling a mitzvah right now. The second mitzvah involved in that is telling the story of it. That mitzvah, telling the story of the Exodus, only applies Seder nights. Seder night, we have two, but Seder night really is when it applies. So it applies to that time, actually telling the story. That mitzvah is telling the story. It's separate from remembering. It's the mitzvah of telling the story. It's the mitzvah of transferring the experience from parent to child. This is what we saw, right? So we didn't see it, but our great, 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 great grandparents saw it, and they're telling us each generation. It's supposed to be, as much as possible, a multi-generational event. This year we're having a four-generation Seder. So, and it's hard, even our fourth generation back didn't see it. There's not an unbroken chain there. There's an unbroken chain of Seders, but not of straight faith passing on. My father-in-law, even though he was born speaking Yiddish and didn't learn, Yiddish is Jewish, right? If you translate it into English, Yid is a Jew. So a lot of people say, do you speak Jewish? Which is Yiddish, right? So he spoke Yiddish in the Bronx. He was born in the Bronx. He didn't learn how to speak Christian until he went to school. So, but that's what he thought it was. There's Yiddish and there's Christian, right? So now he speaks Christian every day. That's his main language. But he was born into a Yiddish-speaking, secular Jewish family, but very Jewish, right? A very Jewish but secular family. So he did not have the faith transference, but certainly a Seder every year. Certainly the understanding that somehow as Jews, there's something special. He didn't know what it was necessarily. So there's not an unbroken chain of transmission of concept, but at least of there's something to transmit, but they didn't know what it was. Kind of like passing on a box without knowing what's inside, but just like take the box. So that's kind of what his Seder experience was. I took the box. I'm giving you the box, but he doesn't know what's in it. So many of us have experienced Seders like that, where you don't quite know what's in it, but at least you're getting it. I encourage you to open the box, which takes more time. And it's great to have a class like this, and it takes more time than a one-hour class or a three-year experience even. You know, it's a lot of work to open the box. But the more you open it, the more exciting it is. Anyway, so what really happened was that initial emunah experience. And that's what the Seder is supposed to be, is us passing that on to our children. This is something we experienced. We experienced God in our lives. It's not that God, just that God created the world, said it, and forget it. However you want to think that he created the world, whether it's through evolution, whether it's through a Big Bang, whether, but it wasn't just a Big Bang, and now it's here, and he's not involved. The Exodus teaches us he is involved. He's involved in history, and that's why he did all that stuff once. We see now, as students of Jewish history, looking back, we see incredible involvement throughout, and that's part of why we study Jewish history. It's not just to know how we got here, but to see all the amazing things that had to happen to get us here and to still exist today.
But you're saying pass on, not pass over.
Right. We still didn't get to the name. So let's do that. Okay, so what was passed over? It must be that the name says something essential about the holiday, because you're not going to just name a holiday after the 10th plague. Right? Doesn't make sense, right? Now that we've discussed all this, doesn't make sense that it should be named after one of the displays. Right? It could be named after all of them, but why after the one? So what was passed over was our readiness to receive the mission. We weren't fully ready, right? But God made a promise. He promised Abraham, your children will be the ones. And so the truth is, we were not ready when we were taken out. We were taken out as a ragtag bunch of slaves who didn't even fully want to go. Right? Much like us today, we're looking at Israel thinking, oh, I don't know, kind of comfortable where I live, and I have a fenced yard for my dogs, and, you know, whatever. I would have to work with language to get it, make an income in another country, and it's not so easy. I'd rather stay here. Right? When, instead of going to our land that we finally have after 2,000 years, right? I'm just talking about myself. I'm not jumping up. I would like to go. I certainly wanted to go much earlier in my life. Would it be easy to go now? But I'm part of a group of people who aren't. We're here. Right? So the same thing in Egypt, and same thing at many times in our history. A lot of Jews were quite comfortable where they were, and they weren't really rushing into the mission. Even though we have an important mission, it turns out that many Jews are not rushing to make it happen. Which is why sometimes God has to push us into making it happen. And we don't always get the choice. So we weren't ready. We were in Egypt. We were careful. We did maintain some sense of separate identity. Apparently, we maintained our sense of the way that we dressed, which was distinct from the Egyptians, and our names and circumcision. What else was the three things? So we did maintain a sense of distinctness and identity. However, we also did quite a bit of assimilating. Part of having a paschal offering was to sacrifice to our God, their God. Right? They venerated sheep. Bless you. Sheep was one of their gods. So it was part of the initial paschal offering. And think about it, the first Seder, which I have here on your list, the first Seder. Where was the first Seder? No.
In the desert? Or?
It was actually in Egypt. Yes, the Last Supper was a Seder, but it wasn't the first Seder. Oh. The first Seder was actually in Egypt before they got out. So before the Exodus, right? They remember, from the movie? Everybody's seen the movie, Ten Commandments? Mm-hmm. Right? They put the blood on the doorposts, and then there's the angel of death passes over their houses. But where's the blood from? From the paschal offering, from the lamb that they slaughtered, right?
The lamb shanks on the Seder plate.
Right. So their first paschal offering and the first Seder, the matzah, the maror that recalls the bitterness of slavery, that was in Egypt before we were freed. The first Seder is before we were freed. So the Seder is not necessarily, although it is also about celebrating our redemption, it's actually about our trust. The first Seder was, I trust you, God. You said you're going to take me out. You're going to take me out. I'll have a Seder right here, right now, while I'm still a slave, because I trust you.
So who led that? Like, was Moses the one that, or was the Seder tradition going on for a long time?
No, that was the first Seder. That was the first Seder. So was it led? It was not like our Seders today. It was, you had matzah, maror, and the lamb, right? I don't know if there were four cups or not. I'm not sure about that.
How did they not eat matzah, though?
Because God said, make matzah and eat matzah.
You're going to need to learn how to bake fast, so
uh-huh. Matzah. It's interesting. So it was not, I'm going to teach you how to bake fast because you're about to leave quick and you're going to have to learn how to bake fast. That's not what it was. It was, make matzah. Make this bread of affliction. This is how you do it. You have to make it fast, right? It's within 18 minutes. So how is that? Probably to Moses, who told it to the Jews, who they made a Seder. But if you look in the text, and I didn't bring that, you know, where that is, but that is what happened. It was in Egypt. The first Seder was in Egypt before they actually left. So when we talk about, right, making matzah, we bake matzah because the dough didn't have a chance to rise. Yes and no. Because we made matzah before we left. So we made the matzah because God said make matzah, which is why in the Torah it's called Chag HaMatzot. We call it Chag HaPesach. God calls it Chag HaMatzot. So God calls it the matzah holiday. We call it the Passover holiday because we both appreciate what we did for each other. God said make matzah, and we did it. Even though it wasn't a practical thing. It's not, and anybody who's made bread knows that if you throw a bag of bread over your back and then you dough, and then you go out with hundreds of thousands of people into the desert, chances are by the time you set up an oven to bake that, it's risen a little bit. It's not matzah, right? It's just not. So what is it? It would be bread at that point. But the mitzvah was to make matzah. So yes, we talk about a fast exodus, but think about the timing of it. It was not because even if they would have taken out the dough and they didn't have a chance to bake it then. So God said, make matzah. We made matzah because God said so. It was an act of trust. We made matzah. We did what he said. We call it Passover because God passed over our houses. That's what God did for us. What we did for God was, we'll do what you say. You said, do it, we'll do it. That's what you say to do, make matzah, because that's the bread that symbolizes both affliction and redemption and trust in you, all of that. We'll make it.
So I still don't understand. I hear what you're saying, that it's called Passover because we weren't yet ready to take up our mission, and God kind of...
passed over our readiness.
Right.
Passed
but
over the...
Passed over our unreadiness.
Passed over the adequacy of our state,
but
let's say it that
point,
way.
Like at that
whether
point,
or not we're ready.
Was it at that point that we had that self-reflection that we knew we weren't ready, or when did we start calling it Passover? When did we realize that?
Well, so you might think it's Passover because of the plague that passed over, but it couldn't be as you examine it. So maybe the self-reflection wasn't in that, and did we call it that day? We probably didn't call it that day, right? But how was the holiday named? So it couldn't be that it's named for a plague.
But when was it named in our history? Was it called Passover then?
It's called Chag HaMatzot in the Chumash. And I'm sure it's also called Chag HaPesach in the Chumash. Later on, it's called Chag HaPesach in the moment. I don't know if it is. I'm not positive. For sure, it's called Chag HaPesach later on.
Because it wasn't until we had an opportunity for self-reflection that we realized this greater reason for the name.
Right, but it wasn't our self-reflection that named it differently later on, because the book is God's dictation, right? So it's not our self-reflection.
Oh, so it's just later time that we have a better understanding.
Right, that we start to understand all the things, that we have to actually ask the question. We need to do this self-reflection. Why is it named that? What's going on here? Why did God do 10 plagues? That's important for us to ask, because we're just so used to hearing he did it, but it's not about taking us out. Obviously, God's God. He could do whatever he wants. So clearly he wanted to do 10 plagues. It was important that there were 10 plagues as public displays. And he needed the 10. That's why he hardened Pharaoh's heart. God's not usually a heart hardener, right? That's not, God is all about free will, except for when it interrupts the flow of history, then he doesn't. So usually kings of heads of state don't get total free will. I think we talked about that maybe, I don't know if it was this
possible. So God doomed the Egyptian people.
Well, so... yes and no, because it does. It there is with God, there is a perfection of how it all works. So, let's just say, right? Somebody is supposed to lose $1,000, right? So there's a few ways to lose $1,000. Somebody could pay you in cash, and you dropped it, and you lost your $1,000. Or you could need a root canal. That's really more, right? You need a new crown. Your old crown fell off. That's $1,000, right? So, and now you have to not just pay the $1,000, but you have to also spend the time in the dentist. You didn't just drop it, right? Or you could get your car dented, $1,000 worth of damage. Now you have to bring your car in to get it fixed, right? So there's different ways to lose $1,000. If you're supposed to lose it, you're supposed to lose it. Now the question is how. There's also hows, right? For sure you need to lose it. Now the question is how. So let's just say that you need the inconvenience also, not just $1,000, but the inconvenience of not having your car for a couple of days while that gets fixed. So then somebody needs to dent your car. Now, there's two ways to dent your car. You could back into something and cause that $1,000 or the damage that requires it, or somebody could back into you, right? So you could cause the damage or somebody could cause it to you. Let's say the person causes it to you, right? Now, is it their fault that you now have to pay $1,000? So according to this, it's not. You needed to lose the $1,000. Did they need to be the agent of that? They didn't. But something that they did made them need to be the agent of that. Because you could have lost $1,000 in a lot of different ways. But for whatever reason, there is the perfect math of that person did something negative that opened them up to channeling the negativity into your life. You could have channeled it on your own. But for whatever reason, the two of you had to come to meet in the side of your car, right? So that they channeled the negativity, you received it. You for sure needed to lose $1,000. They didn't necessarily have to do it, except for they did something that allowed them. The Egyptians needed to enslave us. God said, I need my people to be squeezed. But not that tight,
so
it turns out.
Can I ask you a yes or no question?
Mm-hmm. Really you could try,
but
yeah.
You can just answer yes or no. So is this all of that incredible complex involvement in God, of God's energy in our lives, like, is that true for the billions of Chinese people?
Yes.
Okay.
And no. I'm not 100% sure. I mean, and it was a nice thing reading. This comes, the article comes with a video. So the video is different than the article. It's a 9-minute video, so I watch it. So one of the things he talks about is the equality of all creation, that there is an existential equality in that everything was created by God. Nothing wasn't. Everything on the planet. So while at the same time there's a hierarchy of creation, and let's say the 10 plagues represents a hierarchy, the 10 statements of creation represent a hierarchy, certainly the 10 commandments represent a hierarchy, the first word being I is the first word of the 10 commandments, and then from the eye of God's eye, everything unfolds, everything's contained in that, right? And so it explains the unfolding of that, so there's a hierarchy, but at the same time, there's an existential equality where everything's exactly the same in that everything was created by God for a divine purpose. Nothing was created for no purpose. So in that sense, we're all 100% equal, that we were all created by God and that we all have a purpose, a divine purpose, our unique purpose. The purposes are all different, but the equality is in that God created us and for a purpose. So in that sense, there's an equality, and then there's the differential purposes, differentiated purposes. So, but there is an ultimate equality. So yeah, and no, it's very complicated. Sorry.
Thanks for
no problem. So that's the tens right there. I mean, I can't go into the whole long. Let's see. Wait, do we have some time? Excellent. Okay. So what really happened then in the Seder was that in the Exodus was that the Jews' ability to receive and accomplish and be ready to receive the mission was passed over. The prerequisites were passed over, and we were taken out anyway because of the promise. And so part of it was, and that's part of why we have Sfira to Omer, which I think we're talking about maybe next time, during the Sfira period, during the counting of the Omer period. So we have a 49-day period in between Passover and Shavuot. Shavuot's when we receive the Torah. So we talk about a double birth process. Who has a custom in this room to eat eggs at the Seder, hard-boiled eggs? Well, who has seen that, right? That's a custom. Why?
It's on the plate.
Right?
Cycle of life,
birth. Okay, so one reason, because there's a lot. One reason is it's an egg and a chick is a double birth process, like the Jews, right? So the egg is laid, but it's not a chick yet. It's not born. But it did come out of the hen, and now you wait, and it incubates, and sometime later it hatches. So there's really a double birth process for egg-bound birds, right? So we eat that egg to symbolize our double birth process. We came out of Egypt as an egg, but then we needed to incubate for that 49-day period before we hatched into God's chosen people, the nation that received the Torah. We weren't ready to receive the Torah right when we came out. We needed a little recovery time from slavery to transform ourselves from slaves into leaders, really, who could lead the world. So we needed that time. But part of that, there's a whole mystical stuff, and we'll talk about it more when we talk. Oh, we'll just leave that. We'll talk about it more when we talk about that time. But part of the reason why we eat the eggs is because of that double birth process. So we needed an incubation period. We were not ready. So part of what happened was we passed over what was ready, and then that 49 days is part of how we fill in some of the blanks for readiness. And so is the rest of history. What we're doing right now is still filling in blanks. Okay, so that's what really happened in the Exodus, and that's what we're really celebrating, is the fact that God interacts with us in history, interacts with humanity in history, and it's the time that we were made into a nation. Received the Torah. Received the Torah a little bit later, but the whole point of the Exodus was to receive the Torah. Now I have my little, I don't know if I told you, my Mexico Torah, but from my reflections in Mexico. So I recently went to Mexico. I did a Shabbaton there a couple of weeks ago. So in Mexico, who's been to Mexico recently? Yeah? So, and where were you?
Beach.
Okay, so not on the beach. In the town where people live, everybody lives behind a barricade. A big one. A regular house has a big, huge, locked wall in front of it. So you unlock that wall and go in and lock it behind you, and then there's your lawn and your house. But you're surrounded, you're in a compound, every house. Even the houses that are next to each other, so there's walls in between houses, the kids can't run from yard to yard, right? Maybe some backyards might be connection if you connected, if you take down, like let's say you know your neighbor and you take down the fence in the backyard. But otherwise, it's compound next to compound next to compound, and your cars too, your driveway is also, you know, part of your compound. But it's dangerous in Mexico, and they don't trust anybody, not the police either. Not law enforcement, you can't trust. So, and the bigger place, that's just your house. So for your house, you have your wall and your lock. And you don't have a private guard for your own house. Just you are the guard and you lock your own house. For the synagogues that I went to, they're also all in a compound. I don't know about the churches, I didn't go to any, but I imagine that all institutions, at least certainly what I saw, they're in a compound with private security guards hired that check you before you go in. You can't just drive into the parking of the synagogue. You have to tell them, they stop you. If they recognize you, good. If not, you have to say why you're going and what you're doing there. And sometimes they call inside to check. Then you can park. Interesting, on the way out, because I gave a talk in the synagogue at the same time there's a wedding, in order to take your car out from the wedding, you have to stop by a table, do a breath alcohol exhale, and get a green pass from the person before you can leave. You have to present that to the guards on your way out to be able to exit.
Wow.
Yeah. So that was an interesting thing to see, that there's just a table set up for exits. You know, you gotta breathe before you can go. So whatever. Okay, so in Mexico, a woman cannot walk alone on the street. It's not safe. You need to be with somebody. You should not be alone. Right? Now, it's different neighborhoods and different things, but in general, it is not safe. Not even in a mall. My daughter went to a wedding in Mexico, and her friend, who was getting married, Mexican girl, she went shopping with her. Oh, this is the before she came, fortunately. My daughter wasn't involved in this. The week before she came, she heard about it, right? They went shopping in the mall with her girlfriends to buy, you know, linens and stuff that you need before you get married, right? She comes to the car, and she's got, you know, her packages of stuff. They're held up at gunpoint, take all the packages, and then the girls get in the car and drive home. So, which means that it was not shocking to be held up by gunpoint. It was inconvenient, right? Because the girls got in the car and drove home. They didn't freak out and have to get a rescue. You get robbed at gunpoint. This happens. So it's not safe to be by yourself, because then you might get kidnapped too. So a woman cannot walk alone. It's not smart for a woman to be alone in Mexico. Why? They have good laws. They don't have good enforcement. You cannot count on the police. The police pull you over, you just offer them money and you can go. You don't have to get a ticket. I tried explaining. I have this whole like way of explaining things with the learning how to drive. And I said, you know how when you learn how to drive, you first get the book, right? And I'm thinking, I'm explaining like America. They all looked at me and they laughed. They're like, no, you pay somebody and you get a license. Like, forget that whole muscle, then that's not going to work for you. It's a totally different system. Okay, so that's Mexico. Good laws, bad enforcement, not free, right? Now let's look at Saudi Arabia. Bad laws, excellent enforcement, not free. A woman cannot walk alone in the streets of Saudi Arabia, right? Because the law is well enforced and it's terrible law. You are not permitted as a woman to be alone. You have to be escorted. Cannot be alone. So bad laws, excellent enforcement, not free. Now let's look at America. Pretty good laws. Not all of them, but for the majority, we have a very nice system. And it's not actually enforced by enforcement. There is law enforcement necessary. But most of how America works is that most of us agree that the laws are pretty fair and we mostly do it. Should we choose not to, first of all, we can get away with quite a bit, but should we choose not to, there is enforcement at the edges for the outliers. But basically, it's a we all agree to do this system, right? We stop at red lights, not like in Mexico where why would you stop? It's not safe, first of all, and second of all, why bother? So, but here we do. So you can count on the fact that you can go on the green because the other people stopped at the red, right? We have the system of agreement. So we basically have good laws and good enforcement, which means we're free, basically. Not perfectly, right? But basically, there's freedom here. I can walk in most places pretty safely, right? I'm pretty comfortable because we have good laws with good enforcement and light enforcement. It's not like some other countries. So law can make you free. That's what was happening. Part of the freedom that we got when we left Egypt, because it's not just let my people go. It's let my people go that they should serve me. So really, if you think about it, it's not really a holiday of freedom if we're leaving the servitude of one master for the servitude of another, which we were, right? Out from Pharaoh into God. Lots of laws to be a Jew. And yet, those laws ultimately do free, right? I heard a conversation earlier about just in terms of being able to make good choices and have the ability through having practiced making choices. I can eat this, I can't eat that. I can touch this person, I can't touch that person. I can wear this, I can't wear that. Once you've developed that in your life, so then trickier, sticky situations come up and you already have a practice of saying, let me think about what's the appropriate thing to do. I'd rather do this, but it's wrong to do that, and so I'll choose to do this because I have the strength to make that choice. Right? And the laws can free you from your own whims. Not that you don't have free choice inside them, but they can free you from your own whims, and they can free you from the whims of other people in society too. We don't have a rights-based system in Judaism. It's a responsibility-based system. So it's not everybody grabbing, it's everybody giving, really. So that hopefully, in the end, there's supposed to be a holy communism. I don't want to really use that word. But really, 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 in the very end of days, it's supposed to be everybody getting what they need according to their needs and everybody giving according to their abilities. That is a way to do it. It doesn't work in a totally human-based system. But ultimately, that's what it's supposed to be. Everybody should get what they need. Everybody should give according to how they can. Right? So eventually, we'll get to a place like that. We need Mashiach for that because humans can't really work that out so well without the strict enforcement. Anyway, so that was my thought about law freeing, just having been in Mexico and thinking about what it's like to be in a place where there is laws but no enforcement and you're not free. You have to be really careful how you function in a place like that. It's scary. I know here you can wear your jewelry and walk to the mall and take a walk in the park and not a big deal. And I'm not even talking, I don't have the most expensive jewelry, but like whatever, just my engagement ring. I can walk like that, you know? Like it's not huge stuff, but I'm not worried about it. But not there. You're not supposed to. And South Africa, forget about it. You know, and there they have like timed gates that you open right as you're driving in. And still sometimes people come in after you and can jump you and take your stuff and take your car. And it's very scary to live in a place where there's no law. Okay, that being said, let's think for a minute. So I have on this list two types of seders. So we have throughout history had two types of seders. The first seder was a seder not free. And then from that Seder, the second Seder, on until basically, with some interruption here and there, till the destruction of the second temple, were Seders of freedom. We were celebrating our freedom and the fact that as a nation we had independent rule, etc. And then from the destruction of the second temple until now, a little bit longer than the first period, Seders where we're not free. So our Seders here in this country are pretty comfortable, but we've had plenty of Seders throughout history that have not been comfortable, right? So we have two basic categories of Seders, the same type of experience, same type of meal, same type of text, same type of things to do. Seder means order, so it's an order, it's a procedure. The same procedure for the evening, but the two basic types of Seders are Seders celebrated in freedom and Seders celebrated not in freedom. So, and yet, there is a freedom in both, I think. The freedom really is that internal freedom. The freedom to know that we're connected to something deeper.
Okay, so can I ask you a question? This is,
you can.
I apologize because this is a little family story. So, but I would really love your opinion. So my daughter, she goes to school here. She wears pajamas every day, all day. She has for the past 4 years. And so my sister's hosting Passover, and she has said that, in other words, that we can't come unless she dresses appropriately. So my daughter, who's very bright, says, but Passover's about being free, and this is really important to me, and it has been really important to her to dress how she wants, and so I let her do it. So obviously, there's all kinds of parental decisions around there, but how do I explain to my daughter, because the decision that I've made is that, okay, we're going to try to live up to my sister's request and have her dress appropriate, as she says it, for the holiday. But how do I answer, given this discussion you're having, my daughter so that she doesn't feel like she's being oppressed?
Right. Okay. So I hear that, and I think kids will often say to you something like, it's a free country. I can speed if I want to. I can text while I drive if I want to.
Well, no, that's easier to answer.
It's much easier to answer. The reason why I'm saying that is because the answer is the same. Yes, you're free, and not to do whatever you want. You're not free to do whatever you want. What does a free country mean? What does freedom mean? And how are you free inside law and outside of it? And how does law free you? So you're right, it's a whole parenting thing, and I'm not going into sensory integration issues and all that stuff, but, and I'm sure there's tons of things there, and self-expression and whatever it all is, but there is a concept of what are you a slave to? Have you become a slave to a certain way that you say you're dressing and that's all how you dress? And now you're a slave to that. You're not actually free to wear something. My mother, gotcha, bless her, when my sister was little, she wanted to be a boy. And I think at that time, it was hard to say tomboy. She wanted to be a boy. So she wore pants all the time, and she would play football with all the boys, and she played, actually, all her friends were boys, and all her parties were boy-themed, and everything was boy, right? But my mother made her wear a dress once a month so that she would have the freedom to choose that if she wanted to. So it was a requirement that freed her in a way. So even when she got married, she wore a white silk pantsuit. But married to a man, but she wore a white silk pantsuit. So, but the point was, and the concept is here, what are you enslaving yourself to something else? Are you a slave to pajamas? Are you a slave to an image you've created for yourself? So, and that's a different conversation than you would have with your sister about whatever. You know how to talk to your sister the way you have to talk to your sister. But the concept is, what are we slaves to and what are we free from? So you can talk about clothes altogether. Would you dress this way if you lived on a deserted island? If I took my entire closet with me and now I'm alone on an island for 10 years, would I choose to wear something different every day? Well, yes, I express myself in different ways that I dress. No, I wouldn't. I would wear the same thing until that wore out. Why would I bother, like, changing? Like, maybe sometimes I would want a different color or something. But I would not dress the same way that I dress now if there was nobody to see me. Yes, I dress the way I like, and it's also because people see. So I am expressing myself through what I choose to wear in the styles of today. So there is a self-expression, and then are you locked into it? So I'm locked into modesty laws. I've made that choice. So if I see a cute skirt that's just a little too short, I try it on. I sit down in the dressing room. If my knees show, I don't wear it. Right? I don't buy it. So I have to buy something that will cover my knees standing and sitting. So, but I might try it on. It's cute. I might pull it down and try a larger size to see if I can make it hang lower, whatever. So, but I'm not a slave to just what I want to wear, right? I'm freed from that in a way because I have another set of obligations that are more important. So that, it's a whole long conversation about what you choose and how you choose it. And for instance, nutrition. You could choose to eat whatever you want. But if you make those choices, there are consequences. So some of the consequences will be you'll be less healthy if you only eat sugar things. You'll have more cavities if you only eat sugar things. You might not grow as tall if you only eat sugar things. So as a parent, I'm going to require you to limit your sugar things and eat some other things either first or alongside with or whatever it is. So why? Why are there rules of things? And why do some rules seem not to make sense? So that's a whole long discussion. It is not a free country. But it is a free country, right? So I think that's a whole long discussion.
Okay, that's helpful.
Okay.
She won't buy any of that. But
I find in having discussions, even if they won't buy it, it's helpful to talk about an extreme because people can see it in the extreme. They can't see it in their own lives usually, but it's much harder to see it in the subtlety. So you want to start with an extreme, or you try to start with an extreme, just so you can see the concept.
Yeah.
It's a free country. I can text when I drive if I want to. No, you can't, because you're endangering other people and endangering yourself, and the impact that makes is just too great for you to be permitted to do that. So we have a law that says, no, you can't. I don't know if we do yet in Colorado, but we should, right? So, but why? It's a free country. I could do whatever I want. No, you can't.
All right, so,
thank you. Sure. Okay, so...
cute pajamas, though?
Yes,
she's adorable. You know they have t-shirts that look like a tuxedo with a bow tie? Maybe you could find some pajamas that would satisfy your daughter and your sister.
We did that last year.
Right. It's a challenge. One of my mantras was, they will grow up, they will grow up, they will grow up, they will grow up. And I literally had to say it to myself sometimes, like I said, I would be turning around to like serve macaroni and cheese, and I'd go, they will grow up, they will grow up. They are growing up, and it's fabulous. It's great. I love having young adults. So there's still challenging times, but it's great. Having this pack of emerging adults is fabulous. So they will grow up. They will grow up. They will grow up.
So does your sister look at the label on the back to see whether they're pajamas or not?
She and
whatever, that's sister stuff that also has to be dealt with. That's your own family stuff.
That's what I didn't ask you.
You know what they say, that the definition of a dysfunctional family? Any family with more than one member. So, that's good. Okay, so, all right, so we have this mitzvah of remembering the event, of telling the story, but I just want to talk about, okay, Kos Eliyahu for a second. If you can multitask, while I'm talking about the Kos Eliyahu, you can look at your second list, your Pesach vocabulary words. If there's a word you don't know, we can have a few seconds to talk about it at the end. I just made a list of Pesach vocabulary words. This is from my glossary, which someday, hopefully, God willing, will be published. But I have an appendix in the end of words for each holiday, just so that people could familiarize themselves with the words for each holiday. So this is just from that. Some you need to know, some you don't need to know, but whatever, we could talk about that. So the Eliyahu's cup, okay? We all open the door at the Seder, right? There's a certain time we go to the front door, we open it. Why? Not so Eliyahu can come in and drink the wine, okay? I just want to disabuse you of this point. That is not why we open it. So I tried starting to tell this whole thing that I'm going to tell you now to my daughter-in-law, Gitti, who's from Muncie, a from forever family, right? And as soon as I said, we don't call it the cup of Eliyahu because Eliyahu drinks from it. And she put her hands over her ears and she started stamping her feet. She's like, you're destroying my entire childhood. I'm not listening. I'm not listening. I'm like, it's not Santa Claus. It's okay.